Today's program has been brought to you by the Heritage Meat Shop, located in the historic Essex Street Market in New York City. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, I'm Clay Gordon, and you're listening to Straight from the Source, streaming to you on the Heritage Radio Network. You can always find the show archived on heritageradionetwork.org and as a podcast on iTunes. In the nearly 20 years I've been following the chocolate industry literally from tree to mouth, I visited cacao farms throughout the Americas and spent times with farmers, merchants, and some of the world's best chocolate makers. Growing cacao is very hard work, and it's hard not to notice that farmers are often not paid fairly for the work that they do. Straight from the Source is inspired by those experiences with a mission of exploring issues in fair and ethical sourcing in cacao, chocolate, coffee, and other foods with participants involved in every link of the supply chain, from growers to producers to chefs, certification bodies, and organizations interested in promoting the concept of good food. My topic today is the future of chocolate. In the first segment, I'm going to present some historical context for the current market, and after the break, I'll be looking forward 10 to 20 years to present some possible futures. Now, in any discussion of the future of chocolate, you can't dismiss the importance of talking about cocoa, the main ingredient. And to start off, I want to look back 30 years to the early 1980s. At that point, Brazil was the world's largest producer of cocoa. And in the early 1980s, there was an incident which is perhaps the world's first when it comes to bioterrorism against the agricultural supply system. We can look back into the 1600s and 1700s where there was the deliberate distribution of smallpox and other diseases on blankets and other trade items, which was used to reduce the population of natives on the American continent as some of the first acts of bioterrorism, but against people, not against the food supply. But in the 1980s, as a result of a dispute in the cocoa sector in Brazil, a disease called witch's broom was introduced from other parts of South America into Brazil. And as a result of that introduction, right, which was an unforeseen and unforeseeable circumstance up until that point, the production of Brazil dropped by some 80% over the course of the next several years. So we have the largest producer in the world, and all of a sudden production drops by 80%. Brazil goes from being one of the world's largest exporters, actually the world's largest exporter, to becoming a net importer of cocoa in a very short period of time. And what happens is that the chocolate industry and the cocoa industry is looking around the world to figure out, okay, where can we go to replace the cocoa that is coming out of Brazil? And so over the course of the next several years, West Africa was taken from its role as being an important supplier, but not a dominant supplier. And plans were laid to undertake something which is new in cocoa, which is to go from growing the cocoa primarily under shade to growing it in the open sun into plantation-style farms. And what we have over the course of a very short period of time in the 1980s is that West Africa grows to becoming the major producer of cocoa in the world. Right now, Ghana produces approximately 40% of the world's supply of cocoa beans, and its neighbor, the Ivory Coast, produces approximately 30% of the world's supply. So two countries are supplying over 70% of the world's supply of cocoa beans. When you factor in the rest of West Africa, which includes Cameroon, Niger, other countries, so you might include Tanzania. There's a little bit of production in Kenya, Liberia, and places like that. You're talking about over 80% of the world supply of cocoa beans produced in a very small area. Right. Chocolate, when you think about it, happens to be one of the most affordable of gourmet foods. Now, and the spread between the everyday price of chocolate and the best and most expensive chocolate in the world is very narrow compared with other foods. So if you think about wine, you might be able to go into a store and get a decent bottle for well under $10. But if you want to go buy a first growth Bordeaux that's vintaged from one of the great harvests, you're talking about perhaps thousands of dollars for the bottle. If you're looking at going to a big box store and getting something which is called balsamic vinegar and bears very little resemblance to real balsamic, you might spend maybe $3 per liter. But if you go to a gourmet store and you look for, an AIB certified 75-year-old balsamic vinegar, with the exchange rate between the U.S. dollar and the euro at the moment, you're looking at something that might cost $2,000 per liter. If you go into your local grocery store and you get a bulk mass market coffee in a can, you might be spending $3 to $4 a pound. If you're looking at getting the infamous Kapi Luwak coffee from Indonesia, you're looking at spending well over $300 per pound for the experience. So chocolate, which at one end might cost you somewhere between $5 and $8 a pound for a decent low-end mass market chocolate, but at the high end costs maybe $100 to $110 a pound for some of the world's most expensive chocolates, represents one of the narrowest ranges of prices when it comes to gourmet foods. Now, cheese, as it turns out, is probably a little bit less expensive. I'm thinking about, going into the supermarket and getting, a mass market cheddar, and then going into a specialty food store and getting a real high quality aged cheddar. And you're looking at the difference between maybe $5 a pound and maybe $40 a pound at the very, very upper end of the range. So you're looking at, cheese is perhaps one of the most affordable gourmet foods, even more affordable than chocolate. There are a couple of things that lead to chocolate being as inexpensive as it is. The first one is that sugar is cheap, whether that sugar is made from cane or that sugar is made from sugar beet. Sugar is extremely inexpensive. Cocoa is inexpensive. And the primary reason that cocoa is inexpensive is that the prices paid for it are not reflected or do not reflect the true cost of production. So cocoa is traded as a commodity on the world market, and the price is set probably in a weird relationship on supply as well as demand. But there are traders in offices in Chicago and New York and London who look at a variety of factors having to do with supply, how much is being grown, what the political impact might be. Is there a war going on in the Ivory Coast, for example? What the stocks are in warehouses around the world, and they set a price. And unfortunately, that price doesn't reflect what it actually costs to produce the cocoa. It doesn't leave enough money in the system, right, to ensure that farmers can not only afford a living, they can pay for themselves, they can get the things that they want for their families, for their children, send them to school, make sure they have the kinds of goods and access to medical and other services that they need. Right. And that's the focus of fair trade and other kinds of initiatives. But missing from that is an understanding of what it is that it takes to ensure that there are money and resources. There is money and resources to make sure that the trees are well maintained, that the cocoa trees are going to be there in 20 or 30 or 40 years, that the farmers have enough money to be able to maintain their trees properly, that there are enough resources to ensure that the right kinds of trees are replanted when the trees reach the end of their useful production life. And by right kind of trees, it's important to note that trees are adapted to the local growing conditions. And so if I bring in a new variety, which, for example, might be twice as productive as an indigenous variety that's been grown in a particular area for a long period of time, that new variety puts a whole lot of stress on the system that wasn't there in the past. So if I'm doubling production, what that means is I'm increasing the amount of water that's needed to grow those same cocoa beans. And that water may come from the water table. And so there's an implication or the possibility that the water table might go down, which could have an effect on the availability of drinking water, for example. When I am doubling my production and shipping twice as many cocoa beans, it also means that I'm shipping double the amount of nutrients out of the soil that I was shipping before I changed from one variety to another. And, you know, where does the fertilizer come from to be able to replace the nutrients in the soil, right? Does the farmer, or the farmer in cooperation with his local community or the cooperative, is there enough money left in the system to either buy a reasonable fertilizer, hopefully one that's not made from petrochemicals or is otherwise, you know, damaging to the environment. But, you know, is there money to be able to create some sort of organic fertilizer operation? And normally that doesn't happen, and the farmers find themselves doubling their production, right, but not having enough money in order to be able to see the production increases through by being able to replace the nutrients in the soil that are required to keep that production going over the course of several years. And ironically, one of the things that happens is if I double the production in a particular area, what that does is have the effect of reducing price. There's greater supply, which reduces price. So even though the farmer may be growing twice as much, they're working a lot harder than they would in order to be able to double the production, right? But it doesn't necessarily mean that they are earning twice as much for their labor, right? So in looking at the future of where chocolate and cocoa is, it helps a little bit to understand the historical consequences and the historical context of where we have come to today. How have we arrived where we are? Right? The whole face of the world in terms of cocoa production, where the shift happened, where cocoa is grown now, is as a result of an act of bioterrorism in many respects. The Ivory Coast and Ghana are now the world's largest producer because of a labor dispute that occurred in Brazil in the early 1980s. Now, that's a sort of phase change. We couldn't predict what something would look like before this happened. And so the question becomes, what can we learn from this? Where can we take away the lessons so that as we look forward into 20 or 30 years from now, or even 10 years from now, what can we see, what can we use, and what can we learn in order to be able to, if we can, protect ourselves from these kinds of incidents, or think about a future in which the availability of cocoa and the availability of chocolate is very, very different. And that's a topic we're going to get to after the break. So we've been discussing the future of chocolate, and when we return from Straight from the Source on Heritage Radio Network, I'm going to be moving on from presenting the historical context, or a historical context, to looking out 10, 20, and 30 years in the future.
Heritageradionetwork.org. Yeah, I was sitting in the back, so lead on.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
You were trying not to cry, telling him the reasons that you had to leave.
Welcome back to Straight from the Source on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Clay Gordon, creator and moderator of thechocolatelife.com and author of the IACP finalist book, Discover Chocolate. Today, I'm talking about the future of chocolate. And before the break, I presented some historical context, and now it's time to look forward. So one huge area of concern for the food world in general is the whole idea of genetic research and genetic modification. Certainly GMO crops are a worry, especially in the areas of corn and soybeans. But in general, the idea of genetic modification and the implications that has on the food supply for nutrition and what it might mean when we consume large quantities of these foods is an unknown and represents a real area of concern to many people in many parts of the world. There have been some internet rumors that have been spreading around over the last couple of years, which seem to suggest that many of the large multinational chocolate companies are looking to completely replace the cocoa supply and replace it with genetically modified cocoa trees. I can put that rumor to rest. In the future, we are not likely to find an extremely quick shift to genetically modified trees and genetically modified cocoa growing in the wild, as it were, out there being planted. And one of the reasons why is we need to consider the difference between the fact that cacao grows on a tree and corn and soybeans are grown from seed. So every year when I want to replant or when a farmer wants to replant their corn fields or soybean fields, they need to go to a supplier of seed corn or seed soybean in order to plant those seeds. What this does is it means that if the supplier goes from a non-GMO to a GMO seed, right, that the entire crop for a particular year can go from non-GMO to GMO in 1 year, right? Because all of the seed that gets purchased, right, it has been genetically modified, right? That doesn't happen in cocoa. The tree takes 3 to 5 years to produce from the time that it's planted until the time it is productive. That difference depends upon primarily the variety of tree that's grown. But over the course of 3 to 5 years, that's a much longer period of time, obviously. But also, you have to take into account that in various parts of the world, there are trees which are in various stages of productivity. And so I have a stand of trees or a large area of trees that's 3 to 5 years old right now, there's no reason why I would take down those trees and replace them with seedlings and have to wait another 3 to 5 years for those trees to become productive. So what I would do, right, if I was thinking about replanting with GM trees, is that I would focus on only those trees which were past their useful productive lives or nearing the end of their useful productive lives. And I wouldn't take out all of them because I wouldn't want to reduce production entirely, even though the trees are past their maximum useful production. They're still generating pods and still generating income for me, for the farmer. And so I would phase in, right,
the new trees over a period of time? Well, if we have an average planting density of over 1,000 trees per hectare, and there are thousands of hectares, and actually probably hundreds of thousands, if not more hectares, of cocoa planted around the world, then you can see that it will take many, many, many years for the supply to be replaced, to go from a non-GMO to a GMO cocoa economy, as you will. Now, one of the things that's going to slow that down is that to date, as I talked a little bit about before the break, where does the money come from for the farmer to be able to maintain their plants? It certainly isn't coming from the price of cocoa. Farmers aren't earning enough in order right now in order to be able to do a good job of maintaining their farms in many parts of the world. Historically, the chocolate industry has been not very supportive in terms of giving enormous quantities of money in order to ensure the sustainable production of what goes on. Now, they might, if they found a super hybrid GMO variety that was three or four times more productive than what was currently being grown and was resistant to every known disease, work very hard to make sure that plants were replaced in a very short period of time. What we are going to find is it's still going to be so expensive that it's not going to happen very, very quickly. They're going to find, or the companies are going to try to find some way for somebody else to foot the bill. The chocolate companies don't want to invest in the scale which is required to make it happen. Where genetic research is very, very important when it comes to cacao is to be able to sequence the genome of the cacao tree, which has been done, part of a team at Penn State University and part of it at the French Agricultural Research Institute, CIRAD, have done a good job of completing the sequencing of the cacao genome. And there is a lot of work in going out in the field and identifying hybrids and heirloom varieties, old stands, and being able to try to understand which aspects of the genome are responsible for disease resistance, which are responsible for flavor, for example, which are responsible for yield. And where genetic research is done is they do a good job of transplanting genes from one variety to another. And what they will do is they will make, or if they're not transplanting genes, what they'll do is they'll make decisions about which varieties to try to hybridize and cross-pollinate. And where the genetic sequencing techniques come into particular play is that normally you have to make the cross, then plant the trees. You have to wait 3 to 5 years until they bear seeds. And then you have to take those seeds and plant those and wait 3 to 5 years for the grandchildren, if you want, of the original hybridization to bear fruit. And at that point, you can determine whether or not the desired characteristic that you're breeding for breeds through across generations. And with the genetic sequencing, what they can do is take a process that might take 10 to 15 years out in the field and reduce it to 10 to 15 weeks in the laboratory. So that what they can do is they can focus on hybrid varieties very, very quickly that they know will be able to deliver the traits that they're looking for. And then using some very, very specific cloning techniques to be able to deliver or be able to create thousands, if not hundreds of thousands or millions of seedlings very quickly and very inexpensively and put those seedlings into the ground. So we haven't done any genetic modification in terms of gene splicing. What we've done is we've used genetic tools, techniques, and research to be able to shortcut the process that would take a traditional breeder many generations of plants to accomplish. So that's a good look at the future of chocolate is to try to allay some of the concerns that people have about genetically modifying cocoa. It's not likely to happen in large scale over a in any short-term time frame. Counter to that, there are some really large changes that are going on right now, and changes that we're looking to happen over the next couple of years that are going to have some pretty profound implications for chocolate going forward over the next decades. The first one of which is that we have two new markets coming online, China and India. So right now, the United States, with a population of 320 million or thereabouts, is the largest single market in the world. And in aggregate, here in America, we consume more cocoa than anyone in the world, any country in the world, even though on a per capita basis, we may not consume as much chocolate per person every year as some other countries. But in total, we're eating the most chocolate of any country in the world. But both India and China have populations that are more than three times the United States. These are populations where there is a quickly rising middle class. There's a quickly rising money class that's starting to travel, starting to become very, very sophisticated, and is developing a taste for chocolate. But right now, all right, the production of cocoa is just barely meeting the demand for chocolate around the world. So as two new economies come online, China and India, there's a very real question, where is that cocoa to feed these markets going to come from? Well, if there is a shortfall in demand, or shortfall in supply, one inevitable result is that the price of cocoa is going to go up. Now, it remains to be seen whether or not the farmer will reap the benefit of this increase in price, but the price of cocoa will, in fact, go up, and the price of cocoa increasing will have an effect on the price we all pay for chocolate. Another thing we need to concern ourselves with is climate change. Now, I'm not going to weigh in on whether climate change is entirely created by man or whether humans are just contributing to climate change and it's as a result of celestial and other phenomena, but in the last year or so, at least, we have seen some pretty dramatic changes in local weather patterns. And those local weather patterns are seeing changes all over the world. And some of the places where these changes are happening are places where cocoa is grown. And we're starting to see the effects on yields, rate of disease, all sorts of things which affect the amount and quality of the cocoa that's being produced in various parts of the world. And as we see areas becoming subject to drought and areas that were drier becoming wetter, what we're going to see is changes in where cocoa is grown around the world. Now, nothing as dramatic as what happened between Brazil and the Ivory Coast, right? We hope. But because it takes 3 to 5 years for cocoa to become productive, there's going to quite naturally be a shortfall, right, in the cocoa that is available as new areas are found in which to grow cocoa to take up the loss of cocoa from other areas. So we're going to see increased production in the Americas. Colombia is one country that's committed to more than doubling its production in the next 20 years. It remains to be seen what Venezuela's role is going to be. Part of that will depend upon the upcoming election and whether or not current President Hugo Chavez is reelected. An outlier here is Vietnam. Vietnam, over the last 20 years, has gone from producing no coffee to becoming the world's third largest producer of coffee. And the Vietnamese government has said that it wants to be able to duplicate that success in the cocoa sector. So we'll see whether or not Vietnam and Colombia and other countries are going to be able to grow their production in order to be able to meet the increased demand for India and China, right? And whether or not they'll be able to make up some of the shortfall as other areas of the world become subject to changes in agricultural production due to climate change. Right? The chocolate manufacturers are going to react to this in a bunch of different ways. And the primary way they're going to do it is they're going to try to reduce the cost of ingredients. Now, one way to reduce the cost of ingredients is to take a defect, which is normally thought of in chocolate, which is air bubbles, and to introduce thousands and thousands and thousands of air bubbles into a bar of chocolate. So we may have heard of Aero chocolate or bubble chocolate, and basically it's just chocolate which has got a lot of air bubbles in it. But what that does, in any particular volume, there's a far lower weight of chocolate. So the amount of chocolate that you buy is far less for the same size of bar. And so the chocolate makers can sell more bars and make more bars with the chocolate that they have, while still keeping the price more or less affordable. There's more research that's being done to find a way to replace expensive cocoa butter that's found in chocolate. And recently there's been research done which takes fruit juice pectins and other chemicals which come out of fruit juices and be able to process them and add them to the chocolate so that you can keep the mouthfeel. So the chocolate still feels the same way in your mouth, melts the same way in your mouth, has that texture, but with much lower ingredient costs. That's going to be a little difficult here in the United States, because what most people don't know is actually the United States has some of the strictest laws with respect to what can and can't be in chocolate and still be called chocolate. In Europe, you can replace up to 5% of the fat in chocolate and still call it chocolate. And in the United States, you can't do that. It has to be 100% cocoa butter in order to be considered chocolate. So there will be some regulatory issues, but the chocolate manufacturers are going to be pushing on that over the course of the next several years, as the cost of cocoa is likely to rise as a result of a number of different factors. And what that's going to do, ultimately, it's going to widen the price-quality gap between everyday chocolate and gourmet chocolate. So you'll still be able to buy gourmet chocolate, which is 100% cocoa butter, which is made from cocoa beans, which come from these exotic origins. It's just that the average 3-ounce bar isn't going to cost between $3 and $7 anymore. It's probably going to cost $8, $9, $10, maybe $20, $30 or more, because of the supply of beans being more and more limited. Right. At the lower end, the mass market end, there'll be increasing pressure to be able to reduce the cost of ingredients. And so we'll see a number of techniques. Bubble chocolate is one, replacing the cocoa butter with other ingredients, which are far less expensive, is going to be another technique that the chocolate manufacturers are going to adopt. So at one side, we're going to say, man, we're with luck. What we'll do is we'll see that cocoa will not fall prey or victim to genetic modification and will stay as it is. And on the other hand, the climate change and other factors, such as India and China coming online and increasing the demand for chocolate, we'll see in general the price gap between chocolate that we eat every day and the special chocolate that we save for special occasions is going to become far wider than it is today. Right. So today I've been talking about the future of chocolate, taking a look at some historical context and trying to apply some of the lessons learned to imagine some possible futures for chocolate and looking at some of the larger scale influences. I'd like to thank Jack Inslee for producing and engineering today's show, and thanks to Aaron and the rest of the Heritage Radio Network team for their assistance. You can always find archived episodes of Straight from the Source on heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes as a podcast. If you have any questions you'd like to hear answered on future programs, give us a call at 718-497-2128, email the show at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or contact me through thechocolatelife.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Got Stitcher? Heritage Radio Network is on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.